This is Rainmaker.fm, the digital marketing podcast network. It's built on the Rainmaker platform, which empowers you to build your own digital marketing and sales platform. Start your free 14-day trial at hacktheentrepreneur.com/Rainmaker. That's hacktheentrepreneur.com/Rainmaker.
Welcome to Hack the Entrepreneur, the show which reveals the fears, habits, and inner battles behind big-name entrepreneurs and those on their way to joining them. Now, here is your host,
Welcome John back to another Nestor. Episode of Hack the Entrepreneur. Thank you so much for joining me today. I am your host, John Nestor, but you can call me Johnny. My guest today is a brilliant technology entrepreneur with incredibly lofty goals for himself and his business. He is the founder and CEO of Freelancer.com, a global online freelancing and crowdsourcing marketplace, but this is in no way his first entrepreneurial venture. To date, Freelancer.com has acquired 18 outside companies to add to its arsenal, with Escrow.com being the very, very most recent. My guest has received countless awards for technology, social influence, as well as entrepreneurship. Now, let's hack Matt Berry. Let's take a moment to thank our sponsor, FreshBooks. Beautifully designed and brilliantly laid out and simple, cloud accounting software made specifically for small business owners like you and me. Your business is going online, so should your cloud accounting software. You will know that your data is safe, secure, and always backed up to multiple data centers, so you will never lose it, and you will always have it if your tax auditor comes knocking. Stay on top of your business with a clear picture of its financial health. Try FreshBooks free today. Go to freshbooks.com/hack and enter Hack the Entrepreneur in the How Did You Hear About Us section. We are back with another episode of Hack the Entrepreneur, and today we have an extra special guest. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely my pleasure, Matt. Let's jump straight into this. Mm-hmm. Matt, as an entrepreneur, can you tell me what is the one thing that you do that you feel has been the biggest contributor to your successes so far?
Running a fast-growing technology company, probably if I could distill it down to one thing, it's like being the coach on an all-star, you know, football team. It's all about getting the right talent into your company, motivating that talent, incentivizing that talent, and really driving it and training it up. And you know, I think I've been very lucky with this company and companies in the past as well, but particularly with Freelancer, to attract really A-grade talent to the team. People, you know, obviously you're smarter than me, you're more capable. And, you know, really my job is to really give them confidence, encouragement, put them in the right positions, you know, incentivize them and really help this sort of all-star team, you know, drive the business to the next level, unlock resource contention, do resource allocation, and really just kind of make it easy for that talent to really, really, really thrive.
And where did you acquire this skill and this knowledge that you even needed to be this coach? Not everybody goes into business with that sort of forethought.
Well, I mean, I think it's something that's kind of really just come about. I think if I kind of think back to when I went down the path of being an entrepreneur, I think fundamentally I discovered I was unemployable at a very early age. And so if I kind of wanted to get, you know, to have a decent life and do things I wanted to do, I had to kind of create a job rather than take a job. And to do that, it's pretty tough to do that by yourself, even though I had at some point in the past thought, well, wonder if you could kind of run a business as an online entrepreneur, kind of just sitting at home with an online virtual workforce and actually not hiring any physical staff. But I got to a point where, you know, I did need to hire people. And really, I mean, the best way that you as a CEO can improve yourself is just attracting great people around you who are smarter, more capable, and really just, they're the guys that really drive, you know, drive the business. I mean, you know, if you hire A's, they'll attract other A's. You can throw them incredibly tough problems and those problems will get solved. If you hire B's, they'll attract C's, right? And so really my philosophy is to hire the best people I can possibly find and afford. And over time, you build a collection of really, really talented people and they'll attract, you know, more and more talented people.
That's excellent. Are you ever, like, maybe, is it hard to hire people that you feel are possibly smarter than you in their field and to be like, well, I'm the CEO, though, and the founder of this company. You know what I mean? Is it ever hard on the ego in that way? Because I know people that never want to hire somebody that will outshine them and make them not look like they are. But you seem to be the exact opposite.
Look, I think as a manager, it's your greatest failing when you think when you want to try and build a moat around you and try and be the smartest guy in the room. I mean, obviously, I mean, we have 420 staff in the business, and over time, there have been people who have got themselves into certain positions and, you know, not wanted to hire people who are, you know, more experienced and more capable. And what ultimately happens is that their job function breaks down, because at some point, you know, you can kind of fake it for a while, but at some point, you know, you really become the bottleneck and a critical point of failure, and that becomes immediately obvious to the entire organization. So, you know, you have to be practical and pragmatic. I mean, it's, you know, this technology industry is just growing so rapidly and things are changing so quickly. It is absolutely impossible to be an expert in every field. And, you know, and even being, I mean, I'm 41 years old. I mean, even being at the age of 41, there's a lot of inertia that you kind of have because you've been trained up with old technologies, old ways, et cetera, in the past. And really, you know, it's kind of, it's great. I mean, I make a comment that kind of only work with PhDs, you know, poor, hungry, driven, right? You kind of get, you know, some of these fresh grads coming out of school and they don't have all of the baggage or the inertia of the old ways of doing things. And they're trained up on some really modern new technologies that, you know, you just need to be at the cutting edge now to kind of really drive a business like this.
I love that. Poor, hungry, driven. So let's go back a couple minutes. How you said early on you realized you were unemployable and you just could not work for somebody else. Could you take us back to that time and when you realized this about yourself, Matt?
Well, I mean, so my background is I did engineering and computer science at City University. I was fortunate to go to Stanford in 97, 98 and did a master's in electrical engineering. And, you know, all throughout university, I kind of had run little businesses on the side. I didn't really think of myself really as an entrepreneur. I kind of just did things I kind of like to do. But then I had some sort of traditional jobs as I did graduate, working for, you know, more corporate sort of style companies. And I guess, you know, I like to move quickly and I like to kind of question authority and ask, well, why are we doing it this way? Isn't there a better way of doing things? And, you know, sometimes that when you're in part of a corporate bureaucracy, that doesn't always get looked at in the right way. And I just kind of found myself, you know, both myself kind of rejecting the system and the system sort of rejecting me. So I kind of thought to myself, well, gee, I need to kind of create my own destiny here. And I mean, the great thing about being an entrepreneur today in technology is you get to create the future, right? I mean, you get to kind of imagine these amazing things and make them real. I'm going to try and make the world a better place through building great products and great services. And so I think it's a pretty magical time to be an entrepreneur. And it kind of, you know, as I kind of went down the path of doing my own thing, I really, you know, loved it and enjoyed it. And, you know, you can really take your mind wherever you want to take it and you work around really, really great people that, you know, people that you really want to work with. And I tell you, I hate weekends, right? I hate it when you kind of like, you go home and it's like, okay, what am I going to do? I'll maybe go down to the pub or, you know, whatever. But yeah, I love coming to the office and just the buzz being around really, really smart, excited people doing amazing things because it's just a great learning experience. I think a lot of people that work for freelance.com kind of feel the same way. They come to work and they love it because you're around just amazing people doing amazing things. I mean, at the moment it's 10:30 p.m. here on a Thursday night. There's, you know, about a dozen people just sitting about 10 meters away from me. I told them to be very quiet, but they're just, you know, just talking about work and, you know, different things we could do with the business and so forth. It's a pretty amazing place.
It is. And So correct me if I'm wrong, but was your first business, like major business, Sensory Networks?
Yeah, that's what you classify first major business. Yeah.
Did you do businesses before that? Like,
yeah, I did, but there are all sorts of, you know, little attempts at startup and so forth. So Sensory was the first real one. We went out there and, you know, that business we built integrated circuits for high performance scanning of network traffic. So an incredibly complicated product. You know, the technology today actually runs at about 180 gigabit per second. And we built that using field programmable gate arrays that we put on a card, like a graphics card. Like you think of a graphics accelerator on a graphics card. This is a accelerator for scanning network traffic at high speeds. And it was useful in things like, you know, firewalls and security appliances and so forth. So we supply that technology to people like LG and McAfee and so on.
So that seemed like a logical progression because of electrical engineering, obviously.
That's right.
Stanford, right?
That's right. I think, you know, this is a classic, I guess, entrepreneurial mistake was, you know, I'd graduated from Stanford. I'd studied security over many, many, many years. I actually had a little consulting business in security that I started back in 1990, or was at university back in Sydney. So it would be 1994 or 5 or so. So very, very early days in the security space. And I studied VLSI design and computer architecture at Stanford. So you know, I came out and I was really more in love with the technology than I was thinking about, am I solving a problem? Yeah. And every company needs to be solving a problem. And that problem, you better be a painkiller rather than a vitamin. You know, because vitamins we'd all love to buy and would love to take, but you know, if it, you know, we forget, and you know, if I've got pain, I've got toothache, I want to pay for a painkiller immediately, and I want it now. And so that company was really a solution looking for a problem. You know, I thought, we had some theories that you know, networks are getting faster and faster. You need to be able to look deeper and deeper into the network and understand what's going on the network. So therefore, you'd need an accelerator, etc. But yeah, there were a number of issues with that particular company in terms of, you're building gigabit scanning technology in a world back in 2001 where there's no gigabit networks being deployed. Right? It was way too early to the market. And then fundamentally, the way in which we sold the technology, you know, we sold to OEM because we were not confident in building a enterprise sales team being fresh graduates out of an engineering program. So we thought maybe sort of a VP engineering to VP engineering sort of a sale would be something that we'd be more comfortable in doing. So we chose to sell the technology piecemeal as an OEM chip or a card that goes inside a piece of equipment. But unfortunately, that business model is a squeeze play. And you know, the vendors are not really going to increase the cost of their product to the ultimate customer to incorporate your technology. So some other component inside that box has to give. And ultimately, we're battling the Intel chip, and which was not a winning a winning strategy. that's a very much a loss-making strategy. So, you know, there was a lot of, certainly it was a massive learning experience for me. The business actually ultimately did sell to Intel. And ultimately, we went from a hardware model to a software model. And in fact, the software ends up running faster than the hardware due to really smart things that some of the guys did, the cache. So, but yeah, that business has been acquired by Intel. and ultimately, it's in a better place because when you're supplying OEM to the big guys and you're trying to sell into a Cisco or a Juniper or what have you, they're not going to buy from a startup, but they'll certainly buy from Intel. So, yeah, that was a classic learning experience. I think that was really my trial by fire in the real world of entrepreneurship, where you know anyone can hold the rudder when the sea is calm, but when the proverbial really hits the fan, that's when you kind of really, really, really do learn. And then that business, that was 6 years of just great people, great technology, but we had business model failure, we had market failure, being too early to market, we had very troublesome investors that were at each other's throats, and if not, they're at our throats. It was a loss making business for its entire life because the business model of a hardware business is an incredibly difficult business to build. And that's why all the VCs today really focus on software companies and apps in particular, because there's online marketplaces and things like that, because there's only one copy of the software. Mm-hmm. Websites, inventory, you've got not making any money because you can't sell anything, and if you've got too much, it's depreciating on the shelf pretty quickly, and you've got to type a lot of capital. So that was a business where I really, really did learn a tremendous amount, and that really paved the path for mm-hmm. for what came next, which was Freelancer.
Yeah, I love that. Painkiller, not a vitamin.
Yeah.
It's such a crucial difference.
Well, even better, you want a narcotic, right? To get them hooked, right? So, something like Uber, right? So when you use the service once, and it not only does it serve a real pain, but it's just so addictive that if I try and stop using the product, that I have withdrawal symptoms. Yeah, so.
I love that. So, but it was interesting because I thought that Sensory Networks was your first sort of venture into like creating and founding a company, but you said that there was a bunch before it that just, I guess, never made it or never took off.
Yeah, there were a bunch before that. I was not the original founder. I was kind of brought in.
Okay.
Or, ideas that, were not scalable ideas, that, service oriented businesses, or they were not, the market wasn't right, or, things like that. All the common mistakes you kind of make in your kind of first and second companies. The good thing is if you can kind of fail fast, you can learn quickly and then move on. But, Sensory was the one where, really had a great team and great technology, and persevered for 6 years. But also, ultimately that business ran from 2001 to about 2013 and sold to Intel. So I left about 2006.
Yeah. Cause I was just wondering how you come out of university, you maybe do some security consulting, you get corporate a job at one point, and then all of a sudden you go into founding a company that ends up getting acquired by Intel. It's a big gap I thought there was there. I was like, what is the mindset of coming out of college, becoming a consultant? That makes sense. That's a natural progression. And then you usually go into a service type business, or you try and grow your freelancing in some way and confuse it with entrepreneurship sometimes. But then there's a magnitude of scale difference to creating, especially then, a leap to freelancer, which is massive.
Well, I can give you the short story of kind of how it all came about. I mean, the consulting was happening when I was back at City University. And so, you know, very early, some of the guys I was kind of studying with at university were really into network security into the early days of when the web really was coming about. And so, you know, we'll sort of supplementing our income, sort of installing firewalls and so forth. Back then, you could sell a firewall for $30,000 as a piece of software, which is, you know, very different days. But then after I finished Stanford, I actually joined a startup. So I joined a startup called Securify, and I was employee number 8. It was a startup that was founded by all these rock stars in cryptography. So you had, you know, Tal El-Ghamal from the El-Ghamal crypto system was the CEO. You had, you know, just all these just really, really well-known people working there. And it's kind of interesting because leaving Stanford in 98, you know, it was a pretty magical time because, you know, Google was just starting, PayPal started by one of the guys in my class. You know, all these big businesses were kind of just getting going. And I joined the startup that had a whole bunch of rock stars in it. I thought this is going to be, you know, this is going to be a bit of a sure thing because of the big names. And it was kind of funny seeing that all my classmates were the ones that ended up starting the businesses, end up being, you know, worth, you know, $70 billion. And this company formed by rock stars ultimately did sell. It was 9 months old. It had about 22 people. It had no revenue, no products, and sold for $64 million. And we thought it was too low. it was pretty crazy times back then. But then after that, I went back to Australia because it was around 2000 at this point. And I actually came back here before the crash. And I decided to get into venture capital because that sounded like a really exciting sort of thing because obviously it was, you know, 97, 98, it was all, the boom was happening. Unfortunately, in venture capital, if you're a really young guy or girl and you get into venture capital and it's not your money, it is an incredibly boring business and it is an incredibly soul-destroying business. And the reason why is every day you're meeting entrepreneurs, every day they're pitching your plans, every day you're reading these plans, every day you go, okay, I'm reading 50 business plans. There's like at least 4 or 5 great ideas here that maybe some need a bit of workshopping or you need to bring one or two of them together. And every day you're meeting these entrepreneurs and every day you're disappointing them because, I mean, but in the fund that I was in, you know, you'd fund 2 a year, right? And the 2 that they'd fund a year, they're not going to come, the deal origination is not going to come from a, you know, a relatively fresh grad with a small amount of experience in the real world. It's, yeah, the guys who kind of, it's their money or it's their fund, the general partners, they're the ones that make the decisions. So I was just meeting all these entrepreneurs every single day and not disappointing them because, you know, being a venture capitalist, you know, it's you don't want to be the one that says no. So you kind of meet with people and you kind of, that's kind of actually a pretty good idea. And then you kind of talk to the general partners and it's like, well, yeah, no, we only fund 2 things per year and it's not going to be this one. And it's like, okay. And then you meet the guys again and you kind of like the entrepreneurs and you think they're, there's a bit of potential, but you're constantly disappointing them. So I decided that, you know, when you kind of question whether the economic contribution to the GDP of the country was greater or less than the amount of fuel you consume on the way to work, you kind of wonder whether you should be doing something else. And so at that point in time, what had happened was that my old thesis supervisor from electrical engineering had an idea for a business, and he came to me and pitched that to me, and I said I'd help you raise a bit of money and get that going, and I helped him get his first round of money that I. It was really not in the space that I was interested in. I was in audio and video transcoding. And so at that point, I thought, okay, it's time to now go off and do my own thing. And at BCU, I've raised money for this other business that helped my old professor get going. I'm now at the point where I could actually go do it for myself. And I never really intended to be CEO of the first real business, Sensory. I kind of just ended up there because it's a very, very long story. But, you know, at some point you realize that the only person that's going to be as passionate at building the business as you. You have to just have to go out there and just go and do it. And over time, I had a few good mentors back then that really kind of just helped me with a few just fundamental insights into actually the role of being a CEO and the role of the board and so on. And over time, it's a lot of trial and error. And I think, you know, you've got to go through that sort of trial by fire in the school of hard knocks to actually really come out the other side and actually, you know, be a good CEO. And you know, so I went through a lot of fire and a lot of errors, and yeah, and then basically, yeah, that's been very beneficial for running Freelancer.
And what sparked the idea for Freelancer?
Well, what had happened was, so I'd spent 6 years running Sensory, and after that, yeah, I'd collected some around 8 or 9 venture capitalists, and they were all at each other's throats, and it was all just through the disalignment or unalignment preferred stock capital structure that kind of works in the venture space. You have old VCs, you have new VCs. The old VCs who have been in for a few years are starting to reach the end of the life of their fund, and they need to generate a return and return cash back to shareholders. So they're thinking about an exit or a liquidation event at some point. And of course, the business hadn't really set the world on fire. Then you had, at that point, you had new VCs that had come in who wanted to kind of put more money in and really build it up. You had Australian VCs, you had Singaporean VCs, I had American VCs. The American VCs thought the Australian VCs were hokey, which they mostly were. So they were each other's throats. You had, I had Strategic in there. I had Xilinx in there as a strategic, which was kind of ironic, actually, because we were using their product as really the core device to actually implement our technology. And I thought by bringing in a strategic, we'd actually get better pricing. And actually what happened was after we raised money from Xilinx, they went and said, oh, wow, you actually have got really good pricing here. We're raising the prices. And I said, are you kidding me? We've just taken money from your venture arm and you're raising the price on us. And they said, yeah. And I said, can we pretend this meeting never happens? Because this is like really, really going to screw up, you know, the ability for us to kind of deliver product, because obviously we're a component in other people's network equipment. But it was really Kafkaesque. So in actual fact, I had, right after I took the money from Xilinx, I had to design Xilinx out of the product. And so that's when we kind of had a bunch of, you know, really, really smart guys think about other ways of doing, of implementing the technology. And ultimately, they figured out a smarter way to do it in pure software. So, you know, so I just came out of, you know, long way around of saying, I just come out of this really difficult business because, you know, we're doing a couple of million in revenue, not very much. We're losing a huge amount of money. I'd raised about $30 million into that business. And it just became really, really, really painful to operate because raising money in the venture world, unless your business is going fantastically well, when you're doing multiple rounds of financing in a preferred stock structure, you've got Series A, Series B, C, D, E, and so forth. It's like a boiling frog, right? You kind of, yeah, you look at the first term sheet and you go, that's probably not too bad. You negotiate something a little bit better. You give up a board seat. You give up a few rights. You know, it's all fine. But then you go do raise the Series B. You kind of look at the term sheet, negotiate, you know, get it in a fairly good state, give up another board seat, give up a few more rights. At each individual financing point, what you don't realize is you're a frog in a saucepan in boiling water and the water's getting hotter and hotter and hotter. And it got to the end and you realize, what the hell happened to this business? I mean, at this point, I owned a very small amount of the company. I had all these restrictions on what I could or couldn't do. And just by the nature of the investors and where they were and et cetera, there's all these different options were just completely ruled out for running the business. And there was just so much conflict around the board. It was just unbelievable. And so at some point, I think a lot of people have a rule, you know, if you're going to ever start a business, you kind of need to have a rule for not working with dicks. And, you know, I reached a certain point, I thought, gee, I can't work with these people anymore. This is just, it's soul destroying. So I left. And at that point, it was probably one of the most difficult points of my life because, you know, I'm walking out of a business that I founded, ran for 6 years, had great people there. I thought the technology was great. A little bit too, I think, blindsided by the technology and not, as I said before, it was a solution looking for a problem. But it was a really, really, what they call it, I guess, a dark moment where you kind of walk out and you're like, shit, what am I going to do now? And, you know, obviously the venture, and my parting moment, which kind of got me into a lot of hot water, was I said to one of the venture capitalists, I said, well, if you're going to do this, I think which I thought was a fairly unethical activity at the time. I said, if you're going to do that, well, I'm just going to walk out and I'll just consider this my $30 million MBA. And they didn't like that very much. So I was persona non grata amongst the Australian venture capital community at that point in time. And so, you know, I'd walked out of my business. I was at rock bottom. I hadn't made any money out of it. I was, you know, devastated for a number of reasons. And of course, my ability to go and do the next venture and raise venture capital was seriously curtailed by that comment. So, and also the fact that we very much have a tall poppy syndrome in Australia. Well, not just a tall poppy, but we also have a syndrome where if someone fails at something, unlike in the Valley, where it seems as a positive thing because it's a learning experience that is very valuable for the next venture, back here, particularly at that time, although it's changing a little bit now, it was, you know, if you fail at something, that's it. But, you know, don't touch the person. They blew up a business or the business failed. And ultimately, even though I think the business failed, it actually ultimately did sell to Intel. Actually, it was a reasonable exit for the guys who continued on. So anyway, at that point, I was pretty devastated. I was sitting at home. I took time off. I went skiing. I was trading the stock market and so forth. And I was, you know, working on a few little side projects, and I was kind of looking for something to do next. And I was helping someone get a website built, and for that website, I just needed to get some data entry done. So I needed to fill in a spreadsheet with a list of companies, their phone numbers, their email addresses, and so forth. And I thought, well, this is pretty boring sort of work. Maybe I can get like a little brother or sister of a friend of mine to do it. And I need about 1,000 rows in the spreadsheet filled in, and I'll pay about $2 per row. So that's about $2,000 worth of work. And surely some kid would love to do that. You sit at home on the computer and work whatever hours they want to work, just as long as they get the job done. And what happened was, after 4 months, I actually couldn't find anyone to do this job. And I'd find a kid, and they'd say, they work on it for about half an hour. And I say, this job's really boring. And I say, I know, I'm paying you $2,000, right? I mean, like, it, That's why I'm paying you the money, right? Oh, I've got soccer practice. I've got exams. Oh, I was like, and it's not the sort of job you could go take to put on an online classifieds site because it's just a bit of part-time work. And it's like, where do you go? So after 4 months, I think I was completely frustrated one day. And I think I typed in data entry online or cheap data entry or something like that into Google. And I found this website and it was called Get a Freelancer. And it was horrible. It looked like Craigslist. It was absolutely one of the ugliest websites I've ever seen. It was all these grays and designed with the paint left over from USS Midway. And I don't know, it was just horrible. And I posted a job on the site. And I mean, there was all this activity happening on it. But I was like, is this real? I didn't know what was going on. There's like people bidding on jobs. And so I posted the job and I walked away and I actually forgot I actually posted the job. But 3 hours later, I came back to my email and there were 74 emails in my inbox saying I'll do it for $2,000, $1,500, $400, $300, $200, $100. And I thought, what? Like my entire inbox was spammed. And I thought, what is this? I said, I couldn't find anyone for 4 months. There's no way that there's 74 different people wanting to do this job. I thought, this can't be real. And then not just that, but they're not just willing to do it for $2,000. They're willing to do it for $100. I thought, this is no way that this is impossible. So I hired one of the teams. It turns out they were in Vietnam. They did the job in 3 days. It was perfect. I didn't have to pay them until the job was done. That was $100. And this is like the eureka light bulb moment going off in your head. This is the point where I was a frustrated entrepreneur. I'd walked out of a business that was just a hard slog for 6 years. I was like, how do I go start my next business? I have a tough time raising financing for anyone to go, which is, you know, a critical part in any business to kind of get going because you need to hire people. You know, I hadn't made any money out of my last business. So I was like, yeah, there I am, you know, broke. How do I get going? I can't raise any money. What do I do? And all of a sudden, all my problems were solved. I could hire an online army that could do anything I wanted. The cost was just a fraction of what I expected to pay. I could literally finance an army off a credit card and I could literally sit at home on a computer, I guess, you know, in my underpants and just kind of like build a business. And I thought, this is just phenomenal. I mean, and in terms of my comment before about every real company needs to be solving a problem, right? This just solved so many problems for me. I was just liberated. I thought, this is just incredible. And I go, well, I could hire graphic designers, I could hire programmers. Like, I mean, I can write code myself, but I could hire a whole team of programmers. I thought, it's just mind-blowing to me. And I thought to myself, actually, I need to get into this industry. I thought this is like an eBay for jobs, right? I thought, look, there's global marketplaces for products that are huge. Why aren't there global marketplaces for services? I mean, you got Amazon, which is, you know, first-hand goods and products. Yeah, eBay, which is second-hand goods. Alibaba nowadays and manufactured goods from China. Surely a global marketplace for services is a massively overlooked category that you know, there's no dominant player. And this is back in 2007, 2008 at this point. I thought, okay, so I wrote a website called bititout.com and, you know, put it together, a really rough version in about 2 weeks. And I got a feeling for kind of the dynamics of how the business model worked and so forth. And I did something which I always tell entrepreneurs to do, which is kind of did a really rudimentary financial model saying, okay, well, how am I going to make $1 million? Yeah, I mean, you know, what's the pricing? How many people I need to sell the product to or the service to? How often they're going to use the product? Yeah, it just gives you a feeling for, does this make sense? Is this a business that's going to be real? And I thought, okay, and how much money do I need to kind of get going? So I kind of did a bit of a operating model for it in terms of how many staff I'd need and what's the skill sets. I thought maybe I need to raise $4 million to kind of get going on this business. And, you know, I did a bit of a survey of the space competitively. And at the time, there were hundreds of little companies out there kind of doing the same sort of thing. I discovered there's about 12 that had a bit of traction. None of them individually had really set the world on fire. And I thought to myself, no one's going to really finance me to be number 13. And so maybe I need to buy rather than build and move a little bit quicker. And again, to go back to this point, to understand my mindset, my frame of mind was, I just spent 6 years banging my head against a wall running a sensory networks. So I thought to myself, I really just don't have the patience to kind of start from scratch, right? I just thought to myself that, I mean, that first $1 million in revenue is just the hardest $1 million you'll ever make. Once you've got $1 million in revenue, it slowly becomes an operations research problem because you can start pulling some knobs and dials and actually testing some things and doing things like A/B testing and conversion optimization, et cetera, because you actually have traffic and you actually have revenue, so you actually have data you can actually test on. When you literally have no customers or a sale once every day or two, it's really hard to do A/B testing because you can't send one person that way and another person that way because he's got no traffic, right? So, and it, and the data, the results you get won't be statistically significant. So it's like, okay, well, it's guesswork, right? And so I thought, okay, so I just reached out and I contacted anyone that didn't have any institutional backing. And I said, do you want to sell? And about three or four of them said yes. And ironically, the one that looked the best was Get a Freelancer. And the reason why it looked the best is because it absolutely dominated the industry for search engine optimization, which is ironically the way I found the site in the first place, because I typed into Google cheap data entry or whatever it was, and there it was, number one in Google, right? So you know, the same way I found it was the same way other people were finding it, and it had phenomenal traffic. It just converted horribly. I mean, it was just a giant leaky boat, right? And I just looked at it and thought, gee, there's just all these things I can fix. And anytime someone says that, look, I found a bug on your site or like that, I think it's fantastic because I can just fix it. I know I can make more money. So I just looked at this site and I just go, wow, there's just all these problems with it. I thought, this is fantastic. Because if I buy this business, I can fix this, I can fix this, I can fix this, I can fix this. And I built a financial model for it. The vendor provided me. And I thought, you know, I can, you know, I didn't, at that point in time, I wasn't thinking I was going to build. I mean, at the moment, we're a market capitalization of $500 million. And at IPO, we were actually $1.1 billion. It was the third biggest opening ever on the Australian Securities Exchange. So I wasn't actually thinking that big. I was just thinking, well, gee, it's doing $1 million in revenue right now. I'm pretty sure I can get it to five, right? And if, you know, and really what happened was I negotiated an option agreement to buy the business for a good price. Exactly. And went out there to raise the money to close it. And long story cut short, it wasn't easy, but eventually I did raise some money. And you know, I just started fixing things. And the first thing I did was I reskinned the website. And it went from, you know, the USS Midway to, you know, something a little bit more modern. It wasn't fantastic, but it was just a little bit more modern in color. So it went from, you know, from black and white to, you know, to Panavision or whatever. Technicolor. I went to Technicolor, right? It was pretty basic. I had a friend of mine in New York that kind of did a basic skin and I coded it in, but it's pretty slapdash. And at the time there was no employees. There was three contract freelancers out of the Ukraine doing programming, and there was one customer support agent in the Philippines doing support for 500,000 users. And you know, the Ukrainians were like, no, don't change the colors. It'll hurt our eyes. I said, no, I'm gonna change it. It's horrible. And let me tell you, it was amazing because I another thing I did very early on was I just put a dashboard up straight away. So yeah, I looked at all the key drivers of the business, you know, traffic and projects being posted and signups and, you know, I think revenue and things like that. And the minute I reskinned the website, revenue doubled. Like it was phenomenal because the Ukrainians were like, don't do it. I'm like, yes, I'm doing it. No. And I just turned it on. And literally 2 hours later, I just knew that double revenue permanently on the business. And it's just phenomenal. At that point, I thought, great, now I can hire a bunch of engineers. So I started hiring a bunch of engineers. There are a lot of problems with the business model. I started fixing those problems up. And you know, my philosophy with businesses, the way I run a business is to really focus on growth and grow as fast as you can. And so every time I made a dollar, I kind of hired someone. And you know, I just hired engineers and hired designers and hired data scientists and really focus. I think I've had a very rigorous process of focusing on incremental revenue. I think I've got a very different philosophy for growing a business that you kind of read about traditionally if you kind of read online and the blog sites and Hacker News and whatever. Everyone says, don't worry about the short term, focus on the long term, make customers happy, you know, and worry about monetization later. And I do the complete opposite. If customers are happy, they'll pay you money, right? And so I can't tell you 3 or 4 years from now, I can't build a financial model and show you what's going to happen in 3 or 4 years because it's the technology changes, the industry changes, the delivery model changes.
Oh,
who knows
yeah.
if wearable is going to take over from mobile? Who knows how big mobile is going to get? I mean, you just don't know, right? So, but I do know next month, I can absolutely tell you next month where the revenue is coming from because I've got, you know, these three projects going on, which is going to improve this conversion rate to that conversion rate. I've got a new feature coming out, which I think will do this. And, you know, if you have that rigorous discipline to just focus on incremental revenue and just month by month by month by month, then if you kind of track that over 60 months, eventually the power of compound interest, you get there, right? And every time I made money, I hired someone. So, you know, it's been a phenomenal ride. Now we have 420 staff and offices around the world and 15 million users, 7.5 million projects posted. We've acquired 18 companies along the way. We acquired pretty much all of the competitors. We're out there. Apart from two that is merged and then they just changed their name. So, you know, it's pretty phenomenal.
Yeah. So from bititout.com to getafreelancer.com
yep.
to now freelancer.com and an acquisition of 18 companies.
Yeah.
It's amazing. You were projecting to the $1 million at first, and then you thought you could take it to five.
Yep.
And that was as far as you got.
Yeah.
Now, it's a brilliant story. I love it. And so we don't need, say, financial models for the future, but I do want to wrap up on this quote that I read from you last year,
yep.
which is, we want to be in every country, every language, every currency where people work on computers. Mm. The online marketplace trend is towards winner takes all. Mm. So we need to get big quickly.
Yep.
You mentioned at one point an acquisition of 18 companies, almost half a billion, I believe, as a market cap when you went. I want to know what big is to you. At this point, you have this desire to create something insanely big, and it seems from the outside like you have, yet you feel like you need to get big quickly. What is big, Matt? What is big?
Well, I think in this particular space, you know, you're dealing with fundamentally a market that is huge, right? So you're dealing with a human labor market, and if you think about it, and you know, the every job, every country, every language, every currency that can be done with a computer, that's actually changed recently. So we're now not just doing jobs with the computers. We actually 2 weeks ago have started doing local jobs. So you can hire, you know, tradesmen and carpenters and plumbers and so on. That's this is a massive industry. It's basically all jobs, right? Well, it's at least a large proportion of jobs, right? And you think about that particular market, it's a massive market. And if you look at the size and the scale that the global marketplaces of products have got to, and you know, we're talking, you know, PayPal, I think the last time I checked it was 70 billion, Amazon.com was, I think, last time I checked, 277 billion, Alibaba, etc. I mean, we're talking in the many tens of billions or hundreds of billions market capitalization. And I think that this can be done in services. I mean, fundamentally what is happening is the world is just basically repeating itself 20 years later. So if you think back to 1995, that was the year that the internet went mainstream in Western economies. So in the US and the UK and Canada and Australia, people went online when the internet hit. You know, think back, 1994 was the year that the geeks had email addresses. 1995 was the year your grandmother had an email address. That was kind of like the big year that, you know, Netscape and everything kind of flicked over into mainstream consciousness, right? People went online, and being very consumer-driven economies, they went online, they bought things. And that led to the emergence of global marketplaces of products. So, you know, eBay and so forth. And fast forward to today, and it's really only been in the last couple of years that the internet for the first time is connected to the developing world. So you've got people in places like India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Philippines, etc., that have only just in the last 3 or 4 years gone online for the first time. And you know, there's 7.1 billion people on the planet. There's only 3 billion people on the internet. So most of the world's population actually aren't there yet. 60% of the world's population aren't there. But as the rest of the world connects up and they go online, they've got no money to buy anything. They've got no possessions to sell. So how do they transact? What can they do? Well, they can sell their services. And if they're technical, they can jump into any technical part of the market and kind of work in graphic design or web design or whatever it may be. And if they're unskilled, they can start in something simple like data entry and work their way up as their skills improve. And so this is a phenomenally large market. It is really, really, really early days in this market. And so I think that you could build a company. I don't see any roadblocks in the way of building a company that's of a sort of similar size and scale to the eBays, the Amazons, and the Alibabas. Now, I don't know if it's going to take 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, right? But, you know, that's the power of compound interest, compound revenue, right? I mean, you get a bit dizzy when you kind of extrapolate the numbers out. But, you know, we have a track record now of running for 6 years with a pretty smooth exponential sort of curve of sign-ups and projects and revenue and gross payment volume and so on. And I mean, I guess the last thing I'll kind of add is 2 weeks ago, we acquired another phenomenal business that really just opens up a whole level of dimensionality. And that's, we acquired escrow.com. And this is a business out of California that's been running for 19 years that's facilitated $2.7 billion in secure online transactions to date. And so if you want to buy something like that's a value, a website, a domain name, jewelry, a plane, cars, heavy machinery, you name it, import, export, and so forth. You know, you don't want to send money on PayPal to someone to buy something or receive money on PayPal because you can get a chargeback or reversal or fraud. But this is really the dominant global player in secure online payments, and it has been for 19 years. And we've bought this business, and it's a tremendous foundation for a payments platform. And all global online marketplaces evolve payments platforms. So you've got Alibaba, Alipay, eBay, PayPal, Amazon, credits and so forth, and with Freelancer you've now got escrow. So I think there's a whole new exciting frontier that's being opened up in payments and financial services.
I love it. Your visions are big, Matt, and it seems like I just love how you are even just the thought of freelancer not being just for like getting websites made and like the digital realm. It's like human labor market. Like you, everything that the way I think about it, you think about it on this crazy, grand, amazing, different level. And it's amazing to watch, man. So I do want to thank you so much for taking the time, Matt, for stopping by. Is there anywhere that the listener can go and kind of follow what it is you are up to?
Well, I mean, absolutely. I mean, if you want to follow what the company does, we're, you know, at Freelancer on Twitter, and you know, you can find us on Facebook as for Freelancer. If you want to follow kind of, you know, what I do, which is 99% Freelancer, but I occasionally will write about entrepreneurship or other topics of interest in technology or how I think about growing companies, I occasionally will post things on LinkedIn. I'm one of the influencers on LinkedIn, and I've got a number of essays there you can read about all sorts of topics if you're so much interested.
Excellent. I will link to those in the show notes so they're easy for everyone to find. And Matt, just thank you so much for joining me. Mm-hmm. And just please keep doing what you're doing, because it's amazing to watch, man.
Great talking to you.
Matt, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. You know how they say you are supposed to surround yourself, or if you're in a room where you're the smartest person, you're in the wrong room? I wasn't technically in the same room as Matt, but I was definitely in the right room. Because dude's like a genius and so much energy. And I don't know. It blows my mind, the fact of the thinking big. Most people literally, and I said this during the conversation, but most people buy a website like freelancer.com that's doing okay and kind of not really doing what it's supposed to. You buy a website and you would just try and turn it into a cool online business, not into like a multi-billion dollar company buying up 18 others. But that's Matt. And that's awesome. And that was a fun conversation. So amongst that whole conversation, there was some very, very, very smart things said. Some things that were so smart that I might not have even caught them. But there was one thing. There was one thing that Matt said that totally stuck out in my head. Just there's that one thing. Did you get it? Did you hear it? Let's do it. Let's find the hack.
And every company needs to be solving a problem, and that problem, you better be a painkiller rather than a vitamin. You know, because vitamins we'd all love to buy and would love to take, but you know, if it, you know, we forget, and you know, if I've got pain, I've got toothache, I want to pay for a painkiller immediately.
And that's the hack. Wow, Matt. Yes. Does it get any simpler than that? You better be a painkiller and not a vitamin. Because it's true. If your business or your service, whatever it happens to be, your product, solves a problem, a definite pain right now that the person, your customer, your audience has, then you can be that painkiller. And you will immediately be necessary for your customer right now. A vitamin, although the vitamin market obviously is massive, they get forgotten about. And it's a much tougher thing to get into. It's a much tougher sort of sell. And I love the simplicity of that, Matt. Better be a painkiller and not a vitamin. So thank you so much. That is awesome. All right. This has been a lot of fun. As always, this is kind of a milestone episode. This is the last episode of every episode of a podcast I've ever recorded in my life being recorded in this very office, of which you can't see. Unless you go to my Instagram. If you go to my Instagram account, John Naster, I think it is, or Jay Naster, you can track me down there and you can see a picture. I just took it of this recording space. And yeah, I've recorded almost 100 Hack the Entrepreneur. I've recorded other podcasts of my own and the Showrunner podcast now, and the countless interviews I've been on other people's shows have all been recorded here. We're selling the house. It's being packed up. We're heading out west for the summer for a few months to live in a condo out there. But then we'll be coming back to Ontario and getting a new house. But yeah, it's kind of a big thing. Too bad you can't see any of it because you're just listening to me. But yeah, that's my thing. So there you go. So I hope it's been fun. It's been a blast for me. And don't worry, episodes are coming out all summer. I will be recording in Vancouver, and I'll be meeting a lot of awesome people that are out there listening. Shocking how many people are in Vancouver. And so if you are as well, and you haven't yet emailed me or tweeted at me or Facebooked me, do that. Reach out to me. I'd love to take you out for a coffee. I really would. I love coffee. Vancouver's notorious for coffee. Let's go out and sip on some coffee and chat. But yeah, just hit me up. I would love to hear from you. So that's it. It's been fun. Thank you so much. I truly, truly appreciate it. And please, until next time, keep hacking the entrepreneur.